This morning we're looking at Isaiah chapter 36 and 37. We're now in the middle part of the book, and these next four chapters, 36, 37, 38, and 39, deal with an historical situation in the days of Hezekiah. Previously, we're looking at different sermons of Isaiah, different prophecies, different messages from God. He's preaching during a period of about 50 years. Chapter 1 and verse 1 tells us that he served the Lord in the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. The majority of the book deals with different prophecies of Isaiah. But there are these points in the book which are just historical stories. That doesn't mean the other is not historical. It means that the other is focused on prophecies and sermons that are being preached. This focuses on historical events in the days of a particular king. We saw this earlier in Isaiah chapter 7. If you want to turn back there just for review. In Isaiah chapter 7, and it came to pass in the days of Ahaz. We're talking about an actual historical event where Syria and Israel had made a confederacy together to come up and attack Ahaz. And Isaiah comes and tells them, Ahaz, not to fear and to trust in the Lord. This is another example of that. Now in chapter 36, instead of it being Syria and Israel, now it's the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, coming up against the different cities of Judah and conquering them, and then he wants to take Jerusalem as well. So it's a historical event taking place. So we're in this middle part of the book, where we're looking at some present-day events in the life of Hezekiah. Remember chapter 1 and verse 1, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So now we're down toward the end of this 50-year period of time that Isaiah is working for the Lord. Another thing to keep in mind is these are not four miscellaneous men. How are these four men related? This is going to be important. How are these four men related? They're not just four miscellaneous kings. Or are they related? Does anybody know the relationship between these four men? They're fathers and sons. They're all related. Uzziah has a son named Jotham. Jotham has a son named Ahaz. Ahaz has a son named Hezekiah. Make a note of that. That is extremely important because our sermon tonight deals with the contrast between Ahaz and Hezekiah. We're not talking about a contrast between two miscellaneous men. We're talking about a contrast between a father and his son. That makes it more meaningful. And so these are four men that are all in the same family. So we'd have a father, a son, a grandson, a great-grandson, or however you want to look at that. Father and son relationship. So Ahaz is a father and Hezekiah is a son. Ahaz chapter 7, Hezekiah chapter 36. And Ahaz is an unbeliever, Hezekiah is a believer. And we're going to talk about some of those things tonight in our sermon. So we're in a period where Sennacherib comes up against Judah and Jerusalem. You'll also want to make a note of this, that there are some passages in Isaiah that talk about in the days of so-and-so. And now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah. When is that? Well, that's 701 B.C. And notice that as you work through the book, you're basically decreasing in time period. So in the year that Uzziah died, 740, and then Ahaz, 732, Ahaz dies, 716, when Sargon came up against Ashdod, 711, and Tartan is his captain, and then the 14th year of Sennacherib, or Hezekiah Sennacherib comes up against Jerusalem. So we're as you work through the book, you're going down in date. We're in 701 B.C., and we're going to see the difference between how a father acted in times of trouble and a son acted. The same problem. You got this foreign invading army. The same problem. How do you face that? The father faces it with unbelief. The son faces it with belief. So it's a great lesson for us to think about. This is during the days of the great Assyrian Empire. And did anybody do the digging deeper there about where are the following places located? Hamath, Arpad, just in general, where are these places located? Did anybody?
Syria.
Syria, okay. Any other thoughts on that? North and east. Right, what would later become Eastern Babylon over here. But Assyria, the capital of Assyria is Nineveh. And as Assyria, during the days of Isaiah, as they would go out and conquer different lands, they would broaden their influence and broaden their borders, and they would take different cities. Hamath is mentioned, right? And there's another one there. It's not on the chart, but did you notice that Rabshakeh mentioned it twice, all of these different gods and cities that they had taken? 36:19 and 37:12. But you've got Hamath, Arpad. Arpad is up here just north of Aleppo and just south of Carchemish. So you're talking about places up in here that were taken earlier by earlier conquest. And what Rabshakeh is saying is, we marched into any town we wanted, and their God, small g, couldn't defend them. So your God and your Hezekiah is not going to be able to defend you. So he's talking about, you know, towns and cities up in this area that they've taken before, and now that they've marched down here into Judah, we can do the same thing down here. That's his tactic. That's his strategy in his speech to try to tear down the morale of the people. Why did he want to speak in the Jews' language? He didn't want to speak in the Syrian language. That was the language of the diplomats. And the politicians and the diplomats would use the Syrian language. He wanted to speak in the language of the common people. Why?
Strike fear.
Strike fear, break down their morale. He wants everybody on the wall, and everybody in town later, they can tell it to break down their morale. That's why he doesn't want to speak. It would be like me speaking to Larry in French. Well, that's not going to mean much to you, but if I speak to you in English, you're all going to get the point, aren't you? So he wanted to speak in the Jewish language so that everybody can get the point that we're going to come smash you people. So you might as well just give yourself up. He wanted to strike fear. He wanted to break down their morale. And he's basically saying, look, we've been able to conquer all these other towns. We're going to do the same thing to you. But he doesn't realize that the one true God is on their side. Now, we're talking about different times that Assyria has come into Palestine. And what we're going to see is that they came in at different times and left, and each time they would conquer cities. In the case of Samaria, they would take the whole city, and Israel would be taken off into the Assyrian captivity in 722. But there were different times when Assyria came into Palestine. And this is one of the final ones, one of the final major ones, when they try to come in and take Jerusalem. There are four kings that deal with Isaiah's time frame. And Tiglath-Pileser, that's the one that Ahaz appealed to back in Isaiah chapter 7. Then there were Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. And we're down here in the days of 701 B.C. Now let's take these four kings and let's look at four different invasions of Palestine. So in 732, Tiglath-Pileser comes in. He subjugates cities from Israel, northern Israel, all the way down to Egypt. He took many cities along the coast. And that's why in Isaiah, where it talks about Philistia is going to be gone in places like that, it happens when the Assyrian army comes down. Ahaz is king of Judah and Pekah is king of Israel. And when this happened, Ahaz tried to make friends with Tiglath-Pileser. Then we have the next invasion of Palestine is when Shalmaneser and Sargon come against Samaria. And they take Israel and they take Samaria captive. There is about a 2 to 3 year siege of Samaria. They don't just walk up to the town and take it. It takes about 2 to 3 years to take it because there's a wall around the city and they fortify themselves. So at the beginning of the campaign, Shalmaneser was king, and at the end of the campaign, Sargon had replaced him. And so sometimes you'll see both of those kings mentioned with regard to what we call the captivity of Israel or the fall of Samaria. It's because it was extended over a 2 to 3 year period of time. And you won't see Israel anymore in the Bible text. They're gone. It's what we call the Assyrian captivity. There's no more kings. Hoshea is the last one. So this is the first main invasion. This is the second main invasion. And then here's the third and fourth one. In 711 BC, there were some cities that tried to revolt against Assyria. And usually what they would do on that is they'd say, we're going to stop paying y'all tribute. We're not going to pay our tribute money anymore. We're tired of it. We don't want to be under your rule. And so they revolt. Well, Ashdod did that. And turn over to Isaiah chapter 20. Do you remember that? It says that Sargon and Tartan came against Ashdod. That's the year 7. In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, that's the year 711, and that had to do because of a revolt. Now, Ashdod is one of the cities of the Philistines over on the coast. And so they came down into Palestine, and they left Jerusalem alone. But Ashdod, they took them because they're revolting. They're not paying their tribute. So this is Sargon II, and Sargon II is the same Sargon that came about 10 years earlier to take Samaria. He comes 10 years later because of a revolt down in Palestine. And then they came down again in the reign of Sennacherib, again, often because towns would revolt. People would say, I don't want to be under your rule, and they would march down there and remind them of who's in charge. And so in 701, they came down, and they took over 40 cities. They took over 40 cities. In fact, Lachish is one of the most famous ones, and people have been doing archaeology in Lachish for the past 25 years or 30 years or so, and it's showing the time frame of when they were taken by the Assyrians. But when he comes up against Jerusalem, they're not able to do it. God's on their side, and the angel of the Lord kills the Assyrian army. But here's today's story. Now, look at the years here. 732 to 722, how many years is that? 10, okay. From 722 down to 711 is about what?
11.
Yeah, 11 years. And then 711 down to 701?
Yeah.
About every 10 years, Assyria is coming into Palestine, reminding them of who's in charge. And that's kind of interesting. So there's these different Assyrian invasions, and we're down now at this 701. Now, let's look at today's story then. Having given that a little bit as a background, let's answer our questions. Sherry, we'll start with you. Number one, let's talk about Hezekiah and Sennacherib. And Rabshakeh is probably not his name. It's probably a word for his position. He is a captain. He is a commander. Just like Tartan over in chapter 20 and verse 1. Probably not his first name. It's a captain. So he sends one of his captains up here to yell about how that we're going to take you guys. You might as well just give up. And so that's today's story. Sherry, number one, what king comes against Judah and Jerusalem, and when does he come there? Right. So 701 BC, Sennacherib has come down in. Now, he's not coming just to Jerusalem. He's already taken these other fortified cities of Judah. And there are over 40 of them that he's taken. And so it's now time to come and take Jerusalem, and he wants to do that. Number two, Mason, who does the king send with his army to Jerusalem?
Rabshakeh,
or the commander. Okay, and the men that go out to meet him would be Hezekiah's leadership. These are leaders. These are people in charge of leading the people. So you've got Eliakim, Hilkiah, and Shebna the scribe. He's going to be recording what is going on. So it'd be like sending your Secretary of State, your Secretary of Defense, you know, people like that out to talk with this guy who's come up to send word from Sennacherib that we're going to, you know, take Jerusalem. Okay, number three. Eric, what question does Rabshakeh have for Hezekiah? Right. So you people are trying to trust in Egypt, okay? And then will you trust in Egypt? Will you trust in Jehovah? Verse 7, it's all intent to bring down their morale, to say, this is not going to work. You people are going to fall. We're a mighty army. And so he's trying to put fear in them. He's trying to cause them to doubt God, doubt Hezekiah. Don't trust in Hezekiah. Where he uses that word deceive. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. Don't let God deceive you. And so you've had this false sense of security. It's not going to work. And so it's all meant to cause fear and break down morale. Okay? Joyce, number four, what offer does Rabshakeh have for the people of Jerusalem? Right. Come over. You know, give up. Come over to our side and we'll give you 2,000 horses. And, you know, literally make a wager with my master. And so, you know, that's the other thing you do. And that's always been done in different kinds of battles. The opposing army will come up. Number one, you break down their morale. And number two, you offer them a reason to give up. That's been done in many, many kind of wars. And so it's just common to do that. Okay? And then he, verse 10, I now come up without Jehovah against this land to destroy it. Jehovah said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. That's just not true. You know, he's just making that up. And so it bolsters his case, but it's not true. Okay? Mike, number five, what requests do Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah have for Rabshakeh?
Is the speaking out of your servants in Aramaic, they understand it, do not speak in Judah, in the hearing of the people who are on the wall.
Right. The Aramaic or the Syrian language would be the language of the politicians and the political leaders. It's not the language of the common people. It's the language of the educated ones. And so they wanted it to remain among them so that the people on the wall and others, their morale would not be broken down. They wouldn't be able to understand what's being said. And Rabshakeh says, no, I'm going to speak in the Jews' language so that everybody can hear me and begin to fear and have a problem. So he doesn't buy that particular proposal. Okay. Janus, number six. What does Rabshakeh say to the people concerning Hezekiah? Right. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. Don't allow him to get you to trust in God. And this is the repeated thing that he uses over and over again, in addition to this argument that we've taken other cities, verse 19, and their gods weren't able to defend them, so we're going to do the same thing with you. Okay? Who are they among all the gods of those countries that they have delivered their country out of my hand, that Jehovah should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? I don't know if you remember this, but I had a sermon, it's probably been a year or so ago, where I talked about Rabshakeh had this pluralistic attitude. He made God just be like all the other gods, and that's very, very common. Where God is no different than all the other gods. They're all the same, and they weren't able to do anything, and your God's not going to be able to do anything. And so it's when you look at the parallel account in 2 Chronicles, he even makes more of a big deal about this, that God's just like all other gods and he's not going to be able to help you. And we're seeing more and more of that even today. Okay? Number 8. Larry, what do Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah do after hearing Rabshakeh's words? Okay. I actually want to come back to those charts in just a minute if we have some time left over. So in the 14th year of Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, comes to fight against the cities of Judah. He sends Rabshakeh to Jerusalem to tell the people to surrender. Rabshakeh speaks on behalf of the king and tells Hezekiah and the people not to trust in Egypt or in the Lord. And the leaders ask Rabshakeh to speak in the Syrian language, not in the Jews' language. They don't want the people, their morale to be torn down. Rabshakeh continues his defiant speech, and it is a defiant speech. In the next chapter, God charges Sennacherib, as he's speaking through Rabshakeh, with defying the Holy One of Israel. This is not just a speech, it's a defiant speech. It's a speech that is called in chapter 37 blasphemy. Okay, so this is railing against the one true God. He tells the people to stop following Hezekiah and stop trusting the Lord. He says the gods of other nations were not able to deliver those nations from the Assyrian army, and your God's just like them. The leaders do not answer Rabshakeh. Instead, they tell Hezekiah what he said, and they tear their clothes. And so they begin to realize this is a very troubling situation. Chapter 37 and verse 3, a day of trouble. So they're tearing their clothes. This is a major problem. Okay? So, you know, they begin to realize we've got to turn to the Lord. Okay? Number 9, Matthew, how does Hezekiah describe to Isaiah the trouble they're in?
This day of the day is distressed over you.
Okay? So they don't answer Rabshakeh. They go back and tell Hezekiah, they rend their clothes, and when Hezekiah hears it, he rends his clothes, covers himself in a sackcloth, he goes to the temple. This is a very problem. So you can either do one of two things. You can either turn to man for help, or you can turn to God for help. Those are your two choices, okay? And he chooses to turn to God. And so what he does is he shows his remorse over the situation and sins for Isaiah. Okay, Janus number 9, how does Hezekiah describe to Isaiah the trouble they are in? Okay, number 9, how does Hezekiah describe to Isaiah the trouble they're in? Right, it's a day of trouble and of rebuke. It's like a mother giving birth to a baby. It's very painful. Pray. Last part of verse 4. Please pray for us. Wherefore, lift up thy prayer for the remnant that is left. And isn't that a great thing to be living in such a way like Isaiah was, that somebody comes to you and says, will you pray for us? If you're living a no good life, nobody's going to ask you to pray. They know that you're not on praying terms with God. But you're living in such a way that somebody says, would you please pray for us? That's a great thing. We need to be like that. So anyway, Isaiah was a very spiritually minded man. And we know from the parallel account, the text in Chronicles, I believe it is, says that both he and Hezekiah prayed. Okay, now, number 10. Mandy, what word from the Lord does Isaiah give Hezekiah concerning Sennacherib? Right, do not be afraid of what you've heard. God's going to put a spirit of fear in him. He's going to go home. He's going to return home, and there he's going to be killed. And that's what we see in the very next chapter. So when Hezekiah hears the words of Rabshakeh, he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth, signs of remorse, goes into the temple. He calls for Isaiah and asks him to pray about the troubled situation. Isaiah tells Hezekiah not to be afraid because the Lord is going to cause the king of Assyria to leave Jerusalem, return home, and there be killed. And I'm going to share with you in just a moment the official record, the Assyrian record in clay of this. And Sennacherib conveniently leaves out in the record that he left and that his army was killed. He conveniently leaves out that truth. When he reports this later to the nation, he's only going to spin it and put it in its best light. He's not going to tell the whole thing, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Sherry, number 11. What word does Rabshakeh send to Hezekiah concerning God?
Kind of repeat, don't allow God to deceive you in saying Jerusalem won't be given to the king of Assyria.
Right, it's the same thing. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you in trusting in God. Don't rely upon God. Let not thy God in whom thou trust deceive you. So whether it's don't let Hezekiah deceive you or don't let God deceive you, we're going to come up against you. We're going to take you. And so it's a taunt. It's a challenge. And he repeats the same thing in verse 11 and 12 that he had done earlier. We took all of these other nations and cities with their gods, which would be, north and east of Palestine, what would become eastern Assyria or eastern Babylon. And we've taken all of them, and we're going to come down, and we can take you also. And so much of it is just a repeat. And notice in verse 8, Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, warring against Libna. This is one of the 40-plus fortified cities that he had been taking. And if you look on a map, if you'll look west of Jerusalem over in Judah, from Jerusalem over to the coast, the Mediterranean coast, all in that area, there's a bunch of little towns in Judah, and the Assyrians took many of those towns. Lachish is one of the more popular ones, like I said earlier, that has been excavated from that time. So, and look at verse 8, for he had heard that he was departed from Lachish. So conquering one town and moving on to the other. But he had also heard that this Tirhaka, king of Ethiopia, has come to fight against thee. Now it's time to up the ante and keep the pressure on Jerusalem, we've got people fighting back down here. Let's put the pressure on Jerusalem for them to give up. Okay. Number 12, Mason, what does Hezekiah do when he hears the words of Rabshakeh?
He takes the letter to the Lord's house and opens it up, and then he prays for help.
Right, and this is the opposite of what his father did. His father didn't turn to God. He turned to the Assyrian king for help. Hezekiah turns to God. So we have a choice. We have a choice there. Hezekiah is a man of faith and belief. Okay, so he opens this letter up, as it were, before God. He prays before God. He reminds, almost like reminding God, you are the one who is the true God. And he basically says in verse 18, 19, and 20, the reason that Rabshakeh keeps saying this is they don't realize that these other cities had false gods. They were just made with their own hands. It's not the one true God. Now, save us, that the earth may know that thou art Jehovah, even thou only. And so it's a great prayer. Okay, number 13. Eric, what word from the Lord does Isaiah give Hezekiah concerning Sennacherib? Yeah, we're down on number 13, in verses chapter 37, verses 21 through 25. Number 13. he tells him about how that Jerusalem, the virgin daughter, is going to shake her head at Sennacherib.
He said he's going to despise you, the lamp you destroyed.
Yeah. Right. Jerusalem is going to be defended. I'm going to defend Jerusalem. And it's like someone shaking their head at you. And you are proud, verse 24 and 25, and you've despised, you've lifted up your eyes against the Holy One of Israel. You're proud. And we're going to shake, Jerusalem's going to shake her head at you. You're not going to conquer her. She's going to resist you and defend. She's going to be defended. And by the way, in verse 23, has Sennacherib personally said anything in Jerusalem yet? No. He's speaking through Rabshakeh. So here's the point. If you're doing something that's wrong, you're wrong whether you're doing it or you're having someone else do it for you. You're wrong. Okay? And so look at how Sennacherib, he's speaking about Sennacherib, verse 21, and charges him with defying and blaspheming God. But Sennacherib hadn't said a thing. Personally, he sent his Rabshakeh to do it. So some people say, well, you know, so and so, I could see where they were doing wrong, but they didn't actually do it themselves, so I'm going to cut them some slack. No, they sent somebody to do something. And they're held responsible for sending somebody to do it. It's as if they are doing it themselves. So we've got to be mindful of that too. Sometimes we get a little sidetracked on things like that because, well, they didn't actually do it themselves. No, they were working through somebody else, and so they're just as guilty. Verse 23, Sennacherib has defied and blasphemed God by sending Rabshakeh to say these things. So it's just as wrong. And we need to keep that in mind. Okay? Joyce, number 14. Why does the Assyrian army have success in conquering other cities, and what is going to happen to them this time? Right. The only reason Sennacherib is having success in these other towns is because the Lord is allowing that. He's in charge, not Sennacherib. So let's get it straight, God says. Let's get it straight how this success is coming about. It's because I have brought it to pass. Okay? And then this time, because of your arrogancy, and again, look at verse 28 and 29, because of your raging against me. He didn't personally say anything, but he sent Rabshakeh to say it. And Sennacherib is just as guilty. It's his raging, it's his arrogancy, and they're going to be taken away. And by the way, in verse 29, there are Assyrian reliefs, which is just another way of a picture carved in stone, of when Assyrians would go capture people, they would actually put a hook in their nose. And they would string them together, and then the next person right in front of them would have a hook, and there would be a line between it, and they would string all these prisoners together and march them off. And you don't run off. If you got a hook in your nose, you don't just, I'm going to run out of here. Boy, that would yank you, wouldn't it? So you just stay in line. You just walk, just stay in line, because you're being hooked together. And so he's actually using an expression here of what they actually did to other people. And so Sennacherib would go, oh yeah, I know all about that hook in the nose thing. And so it's going to be different this time. They're not going to be able to take Jerusalem. Yeah, I think it's just sort of like parallelism, the hook in the nose and the bridle in your lips. In other words, instead of bridling a horse, they would hook men together and like they were bridled. And guide them along like they would guide a horse along. I don't know anything about actually putting a bridle in people's mouths, but I do know that they would put hooks in, they would hook their prisoners together through their nose. Okay, what sign is given Hezekiah concerning the remnant of Judah, Mike?
Jerusalem will go forth to Remnant and out of Mount Sinai survivors.
Right. Look at verse 30. This shall be a sign unto thee. The American Standard says he's now switched to talking to Hezekiah. So from here up to verse 35, he's talking to Hezekiah. And Hezekiah is given a promise that a remnant will come about. See, Assyria has marched through and devastated the land. So look at it. This year, you're going to eat what groweth of itself. There's a little bit of stuff laying around. And then the next year, that which springeth up of the same. The third year, you will plant and reap. They're going to be gone. Don't worry about that. They're going to be gone. And by the third year, you'll be able to get back to normal planting and sowing. And so the promise of rebuilding after this Assyrian army has been in marching on their campaign. And they were down there several years. I don't know the exact number of years, but they were down in that area a number of years. And really wiped out the land. And then there's going to be a remnant who will bear fruit. So a promise of hope here. Okay, and Janus number 16, what additional word from the Lord does Isaiah give Hezekiah concerning Sennacherib? Right. So, all of this defiance and blasphemy and arrogancy, at the end of the day, I'm going to defend this town for my sake and for David's sake. And that's exactly what he does. Okay? Number 17, Larry, what does the angel of the Lord do to the Assyrian army? Right. So the Lord's going to assure Hezekiah that Sennacherib will not be able to do this. He's going to return home. He's going to defend his city. And then the angel of the Lord goes out and strikes 185,000. Sennacherib returns to Nineveh while he's worshiping in his house. Two of his sons assassinate him. Yes?
That is very interesting in that verse 36. It says that when you read about it, you talk about the people there. That's the Jews, because all those soldiers were dead. There was not anybody left alive. Is that right?
No, it says that he smote in the camp of the Assyrians 144,000.
Well, in New King James, it says that, let me just read it. Then angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp 185,000. And when the people rose early in the morning, there were all dead.
Right. It doesn't mention the camp of the Assyrians?
No.
Yeah. That's the camp. It's the camp of the Assyrians. There would be no reason to kill any of the Jews.
No, I wasn't talking about killing the Jews. I'm saying this is the Jews were observing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They could go out in the morning and see all the dead bodies.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yep. And so it's a great devastation. And, of course, Sennacherib sees this and he's like, okay, I need to go home. and he does. Okay. And then Matthew number 18, what happens to Sennacherib? Right, it's an assassination. And then there's a third son, Esarhaddon, who takes over. This is the Esarhaddon that is listed in the book of Ezra when God's people come back after the Babylonian captivity. You'll read about him in the book of Ezra, chapter 4, verse 2. So, prayer to God, trust in God. That's what we need to get from all of this. In the British Museum, there is it's about 14 inches tall. It's called the Sennacherib Annals, or it's also called the Taylor Prism. This is a six, it's a hexagon. There's six sides. You'll see this in Babylon. You'll see it in Assyria. It would be like us recording things today. We would record them on paper or now on the computer. They recorded things on clay. So the clay would be soft. They would have a little stylus and they would push their little letters in there and then bake it and dry it. And it would be the court record. It would be the government record. And so this six panels, and it's all been translated. You can get online and just type in Taylor Prism text. And there's six panels. each column, he'll Sennacherib starts up here at the top, Esham, he'll say, now in campaign one, and then he talks about what he did in campaign one, in campaign two, and it just keeps going all the way around. In column number three, he talks about how that he came against Judah. He talks about Hezekiah the Judite, and he talks about this many cities that he took in Judah and so forth. And the well-known statement that a lot of people know about is this line where it says, Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird, I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. Well, that was before the 185,000 got killed. And now, this was after, this was a record after the battle. So he chose not to mention the 185,000. In fact, the date on this is roughly 681, so about 20 years. 701 down to 681, about 20 years later, he has this court record this thing. And when you read the whole thing about Judah, he talks about, I went down there and took, and they had to give me all this stuff. They gave me this and they gave me that. And, then I went on to this other campaign. He doesn't talk about how that he got defeated. And so that's the political slant that he put on it, the spin, if you will, that he put on it. But the point of all of this is that there is extra-biblical confirmation of what goes on in the Bible. And every major archaeological find often confirms. This is one of many confirmations that we have that what is in the Bible is true. And things that go on in the Bible actually happen. And so that's the neat thing about what's called the Taylor Prism or the Sennacherib Annals. Let us look at a few applications for today. We should never let anyone taunt us and convince us not to trust in the Lord. And that goes on today. It goes on at school. It goes on at work, other places. Don't believe in God. Don't trust in God. Don't rely upon God. We've got an anti-God mentality among many people today. Don't let anybody do that. Don't let a Rabshakeh come up to you and cause you to fear and begin to doubt. Past successes can make one proud. And, you know, Rabshakeh is talking about, look at all of these towns that we took in the past. And you get arrogant and defiant and blasphemous. It's good to pray to the Lord in times of trouble. That's what Hezekiah did. His father didn't do that. And that's what our lesson is about this evening. People from unbelieving nations often blaspheme the God of heaven. In the book of Revelation, it talks about the sea beast and the land beast in chapter 13, Roman government and Roman religion, and it says there in chapter 13, verse 6, that they blaspheme God. So, you know, Assyria is not the only one doing it, and it can go on today. The Lord confirms His word of promise with signs announced in advance. God says, within 3 years, you'll be able to, you know, have crops again. God, He often does that, and in the New Testament, He did that through the miraculous signs and wonders of the apostles. He doesn't just give His word and just say, okay, you know, believe in it. There's confirmation. And that's why I'm not a Mormon. There's no confirmation of the Book of Mormon that it's true. That's why I'm not a Muslim, because Muhammad wrote some things down, but there's no proof that what he wrote down was true. There's no miraculous confirmation. It's not just, well, I was raised in the West, and so that's why I'm a Christian. I'm not these other things because there's no proof of it. And so there's Bible proof of things. There's miraculous proof that God's word is true. And so I think that's very important for us to understand even today, because today it's sort of framed like, well, you just pick a religion that of the nation that you were born in. You just pick that one. No, there's reason why we're Christians and not other things. Because there's proof of that. And what's the greatest proof with Jesus? The resurrection. There's none of that with any of these other religions. That's miraculous proof. Okay? He was declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection. Revelation 1:4. So, when God announces things ahead of time, or when he gives his word, he gives demonstration of that. And then the Lord always defends his cause for his own name's sake. And when we're on the Lord's side, we're going to be on the side that God is going to defend. Now, we're out of time, but I think we're going to have some time in our next class period. It's a shorter lesson, chapter 38 and 39. We're now going to look at Hezekiah's illness. Chapter 36 and 37, it's Hezekiah's dilemma with this Assyrian army. In 38 and 39, it's Hezekiah's sickness and what he does with that. But what I would like to do is, we'll do this Wednesday night, Lord willing. I'd like to go back, and if you have an opportunity, this would be the answer on the digging deeper, number where in the Old Testament do we read about Hezekiah removing the idolatry, and where in the Old Testament do we read about Sennacherib's invasion? That would be this right here. If you want to jot this down, just jot down 2 Kings 18 and 19 and 20. 2 Kings 18 through 20. And then jot down 1 Chronicles 32 I'm sorry, 2 Chronicles 32. And those are the parallel accounts. And what we're going to do Wednesday night is look at these parallel accounts, and we're going to add in the material that is not found in the book of Isaiah. So thank you very much.